Strike number one is September 24th or 25th. The dry head overlook site. We stopped earlier in the day and talked to Phil Beaumont at Pryor, Montana, about vision quests that he had had at the dry head overlook. His first vision quest was there about 8 years ago, and although he had been back at least once since then, I'm not sure whether he went through the fasting procedure the second time. Beaumont told us sketchily of his experience, and we are going to try to get together later on and record it in more detail. He has already made tape recordings of the experience, and it's possible that we might be able to use those tapes in preparing articles for publication, or even tape recorded recordings of the vision quest procedure. Beaumont mentioned that the rectangular outline at the dry head overlook, which has the cross at one end of it, was made by him. He did not make a cross, but a single straight vertical line going from the rectangular outline. Someone else added the cross piece to make the cross. I have seen the site several times, and someone almost constantly changes the rocks in the cross part. Beaumont did his dreaming on the ledge below the terrace on which the rectangular outline is located, and said there were about 13 structures along the dry head rim at the dry head overlook. There are some projections that point toward the Bighorn Canyon or the dry head upper regions, and there are apparently some vision quest structures on these little peninsular projections. Right now we are between Arrow Rock and Castle Rock, and Medicine Crew has just told me a story about two crew women who had fasted on the Castle Rocks. Now I'll ask Joe to repeat the story now.
This man's name was Pounded Meat, I think, who was always after these two women. Of course, they were married and never had any luck with either of the women. But it so happened that he got the advantage this particular time because they were fasting and praying and hoping that they would receive visions, you know, or visited by spirits, great spirits, emissaries. So they were in the mood to listen to any kind of proposition. And here comes this Pounded Meat. Was nighttime, and he sang a song, said, "Daughter, do not be afraid, that I have listened to your crying and your prayers, and I have come to help you. So do not be afraid." And said, "It will not be long until two Sioux will be killed not far from here, and that will be the sign when you shall quit your mourning." Then he went ahead and had an affair with her and left. Then he climbed the other castle rock and did the same thing to this other woman. So he had pretty good luck with these women after all. Well, wasn't long till, accidentally, I suppose, that two Sioux were killed not too far from here, and they were going to have the victory dance right away, and some men ran to their lodges to get drums, and this man was there, and he grabbed his tom-tom and ran out there and started singing a victory dance song right away, and it was a song that he used while up here on the rock there, so the women finally found out that it was old Pounded Meat himself that took advantage of it. Well, that's it.
I'm going to try to dictate this, even though the Jeep is bouncing along a gravel road and making quite a lot of noise, just in the interest of saving time. Joe Medicine Crow and I have been talking about the chain of evidence to establish that the rock structures that we refer to as Vision Quest structures are truly made and used for that purpose. Talking to Phil Beaumont earlier this morning, Beaumont verified that they are truly used for such purposes. Joe mentioned that many of the old Crows actually know who constructed which rock structure for fasting. Wallace Red Star, who now lives at Lodgegrass but formerly lived at Pryor, told Joe about Red Star fasting on one of the Castle Rocks about 1941. This was during a time when the Crows had their first sun dance on Pryor Creek. Red Star used the occasion for a more personal experience. Red Star told Medicine Crow which of the three Castle Rocks he climbed for his fasting, but Joe cannot recall at this time which one it was. Joe does remember that Red Star said he used a rope in the climbing, but that the climb was not so tough but what most people could make it. Red Star told Medicine Crow about the type of rock structure Red Star used on that occasion. Medicine Crow recalled that there was a stone pup tent or wiki-up hyphen-like affair built by Red Star to protect him. Red Star would crawl into the structure. Medicine Crow cannot recall whether Red Star mentioned whether or not he used a stone base in the normal Vision Quest manner. Paragraph. Harold Hagen, some years ago, crawled up on the Castle Rock nearest the road and found a rock structure which had some logs or branches over it as if for protection. It is possible that this may be Red Star _S structure, although it may well be that Red Star was on one of the other of the Castle Rocks, and that someone else also built a Vision Quest structure with some sort of protection from the elements. New paragraph. There seems to be no question whatsoever but what the rock structures, the oval outlines of rock, which we are calling Vision Quest structures, are truly used for such purpose by the Crow-Indians in the Pryor Mountains, not only in the past, but up to and including more or less current times. This would include Phil Beaumont, apostrophe S, fasting experience about 8 years ago. Special Officer Richard Leonard recently told Medicine Crow about a cave with pictographs in it, which is located in a canyon, which
runs east and west. Well, for east to the west of them. Kind of
parallel,
this thing that he showed
me. This is the beginning of the second tape. Percy Glenn told Dick Leonard, who is a special officer of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, who in turn told Joe Medicine Crow about a cave containing pictographs. The cave is in a little canyon which parallels Sage Creek Canyon and is apparently north of Sage Creek Canyon. Leonard had not seen the cave himself, but was near it with Percy Glenn. The cave is high up on the canyon wall, to the best of our knowledge, and apparently has not been vandalized at all. This should be reported to the Smithsonian and checked out sometime, recorded.
This is an editor's comment inserted at this point in the tape. The conversation went on with the tape recorder running for quite some time, talked about several different matters, and finally discovered that it wasn't recording during that time because Connor had not set it properly. When we discovered that, we still had a few other items to discuss, and we tape recorded them, and that part of the tape will follow at this point.
On the way back down from East Pryor Mountain, we took a black and white photo of the area, which includes, we presume, the place where Wallace Red Star had his second fasting. The view is from the southwest facing northeast, more or less in line with Pryor Gap. When I get a print of that picture, I'm to send it to Joe Medicine Crow so he can check with Wallace Red Star to see if it is the place where Red Star fasted. Joe Medicine Crow also deduced from the various factors involved that when Two Legging spoke of
Black Canyon, he probably, in most cases at least, meant the Bighorn Canyon. This came to the fore in one place where they spoke of the whole tribe camping at the mouth of Black Canyon. Joe said there was not room at that location for a big camp. Make a note of this in the book Two Leggings. Joe Medicine Crow mentioned that Jasper Long was interpreter for William Wildshoot and Two Leggings, and that Joe was going to contact Long in connection with an explanation of what the Devil's Pocket was, which was mentioned in the book Two Leggings. Joe indicated he would also check on the wording, the book Two Leggings, where they repeatedly spoke of the Vision Quest structures as being platforms instead of rock ovals or enclosures or some such thing. In conversation with Joe and Phil Beaumont today, they said that there was no separate word for a Vision Quest structure, but that the Crow Indians merely referred to these structures as where they lie down. The terminology where they lie down is reserved in the language for fasting situations. Make a correction on that. It's not that the terminology is reserved for that. It's simply that when that terminology is used, it is understood to mean that the occupant is fasting.
February 25, 1969. Joe Medicine Crow and Stuart Connor are having lunch at the Petroleum Club in Billings. Joe has just told me a great legend or combination of two legends, one of which he secured from an elderly Crow and one of which he secured from Cold Wind, who was an old Hidatsa, which explains that the Crows, in breaking off from the Hidatsas, made a great loop going from the lower Yellowstone in the area of the Missouri River west to the Rocky Mountains in the vicinity of Crow Lake and Crow's Nest. And from there south, was it? South to the vicinity of the Great Salt Lake. And from there, east to a place which Joe has not identified yet, but where there was burning coal beds or burning something which produced smoke all the time. And from there north, near the mouth of Knife River on the Missouri River, which was actually where the story really began instead of at the mouth of the Yellowstone. And from there on to the current location. Joe thinks that there is a possibility that this roundabout trip explains why some of the ethnographers feel that the Crows arrived in this area in the 1400s or 1500s, and some of them feel it was in the late 1700s. He thinks that there's a possibility that this big tour took that long, and that the two dates actually represent the time that the big circle began and when it ended. Joe said that a brief outline of this will be published very shortly by the Crow Indian Tribe in a little pamphlet, but he wants to go ahead and finish up the whole thing with all the proper names and filling in the meat of the skeleton. He also mentioned the time when Cold Wind Horse was killed. And I'll ask Joe if he'll go ahead and tell that story again so we can get that one recorded.
I'm working on the approximate date that this battle took place up there at Grapevine Creek, but it right back of Harvey Wilcox's residence there. Just a few yards there, and there's a marker there where Colwyn's horse was killed by some big end warriors. Just previous night, the Crows discovered a small party of big ends, and they were sitting around a campfire, and the Crows shot into it and killed one. Next day, they surrounded the big end, had a little scrimmage there, and that's when Colwyn's horse was shot. And I understand that this incident happened about a year or two after the 60-some Blackfeet were killed about, 7-8 miles west of that place there on head of Muddy Creek, where we saw the fortifications. So I think working through this Colwyn story that we could get practically an exact date of that big battle up there. That's about it, I guess, huh?
The thing which is behind Wilcutt's ranch house is the big pile of rocks, which is kind of a memorial to this battle, is it?
Yeah, it's a monument. A marker, yeah.
Joe says that White Swan, who was a crow that John Ewers had asked about, lived at Lodgegrass when he died, and Joe knew him.
But I don't know just why.
It was quite a while ago when Joe was a little boy. He doesn't remember how long, but I suppose it'd be at least 40 years ago, wouldn't it?
Uh-huh.
Joe doesn't know anything about White Swan being an artist or drawing pictures at all.
This is the end of the February 25th, 1969 interview with Joe Medicine Crow.
1969. Joe Medicine Crow and Stuart Connor are talking in Billings, Montana. Joe, Dr. Ewers has asked that we give him a little bit more information about Plain Feather. I imagine what he's interested in is how old Plain Feather was and a little bit about his experiences, the fact that he grew up in the nomadic days and was through the transition to the reservation life and so forth. Just any kind of a thumbnail biography of Plain Feather.
No, I've been intending to jot something down about Plain Feather, but I haven't got around to doing it. But right offhand, he did tell me the names of his parents. But it was his uncle who more or less raised him. His uncle's name is Iron Bull. That is the name that he was known in various books, but his original name is White Temple, or white on the side of his head. And that uncle is quite a storyteller. He's one of the great storytellers of the tribe, and he was a right-hand man of Chief Sits in the Middle of the Ground, or Chief Blackfoot. Wait, I take that back. Red Bear, one of the last great chiefs of the tribe. And this White Temple was his right-hand man. As a matter of fact, he was a scout for him when he was a young man. So White Temple, or Iron Will, was a contemporary of Chief Blackfoot. And he was almost equally renowned. So that's where Plain Feather got all his stories, to sit there and listen to his old uncle tell stories.
Can you remember approximately when Plain Feather was born and when he died, just in rough figure?
Well, say he died last year, wasn't it, or 2 years ago at age of about 100. And I think one time I figured he was born about 1866, 67 around there. He admitted that he was about 8 years younger than my grandmother.
My grandmother was born about 1862, 63 around there. And of course, he died here just recently. He said he was about 12 years of age when this White Temple and some other chiefs went to Washington. And that was about 1872, I think, that they took a delegation. So he was around 10, 12. He wasn't too sure. Mm-hmm. I think he was younger. Said they were gone all summer.
Plain Feather would have lived pretty much in the old nomadic days.
He knew quite a bit of it. Of course, when this chief sits in the middle, or Chief Blackfoot died, he said he was 12, that's the one. And that was about 1877. He said a year after the Custer battle, that the tribe was still out on their hunts. And that's when the old man died. He was just a young man then, about 12 years of age. So that's about all I can think of. He was, of course, born too late for the war days. And the war days were over here by, 1877, when Chief Joseph went through here. Then, of course, there were raids that the Piegans and the Drowans would pull on us occasionally until way up into 1890, I think, was the last fight they had here. They killed three Piegans who had come to steal horses there. They got caught and they got surrounded and they were killed. Yeah. So Painfeather could have gotten into some of that. You know, those fellas started out early, 1415, but I guess he didn't. Never had any experience in that.
So Painfeather didn't have any war honors?
No,
then.
Not at all.
Do you know of any real good photos of Plain Feather?
I have one I took right after the war, about 1947, I think. It's pretty fair. I used an Argus, Argus 3, I think.
Could I make a copy of that for Dr. Ewers?
Yeah, I think I even have a negative for that.
Good, that'd be great help.
I took one here with my speed reflex about 8 years ago, maybe less than that, but it was too dark. Something happened and...
Mm-hmm. I don't suppose you know of any photos of Plain Feather wearing the Punicu war bonnet, or the one that was placed on the tomb of the unknown soldier.
Well, I think what I ought to do is go back to his old place and talk to his grandchildren. I noticed he had some old snapshots and stuff of himself.
Well, I'm sure Dr. Ewers would appreciate
it. So I'll go in there and see if I could get one, or at least we can get one or two to copy.
Yeah, if you could just bring him to town, we can get him copied in just a matter of seconds over at Casper.
Let's do that. I'll stop in prior.
What Dr. Ewers is particularly interested in, of course, is the war bonnet that Plenty got from Plain Feather. And if there is a picture of Plain Feather in a war bonnet, if you could make sure whether it's the one that he gave to Plenty Coo, would be big help.
Yeah.
Joe, Dr. Ewers, sometime or other, and I can't remember when, asked how the clans were split between the River Crows and the Mountain Crows. Would you tell us a little about that, please?
Well, first let me explain that wording clan. The clans are something else. They're social units. But the River Crows and the Mountain Crows were bands of the tribe, two bands. And each had the same clans you need. See, we generally have about 12, 13, 14 clans. They fluctuate. Sometimes a weak clan is absorbed by a stronger one and it would disappear. Or sometimes they split a big, strong tribe into two clans. So so they're never the same. But by the time they split, the two split, why, clans and the same clans in each band. And I don't know just when they split. Jim Beckworth said in his book that about 1825, 30 around there, that two chiefs got pretty strong. Long hair and sore belly, I think. Two awful strong chiefs, and they sort of split up the tribe. Then again, I read here recently someplace that the split happened way after 1850. So, and I've been asking people when the River Crows and the Mountain Crows split up, and no one seems to know now. But I'm kind of working on that.
Was the sore belly that you mentioned the one that is often called rotten belly?
Mm-hmm. Sore belly or rotten stomach. Or we have the same word for the abdomen and inside or the belly. Mm-hmm. Same word for the whole area. They call him Ada Push. Ada Push in Crow. Oh boy, yes.
Joe, do you have any idea about the history and background of the acoustic that Chief Punicu used in the ceremony at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier?
No, I don't. That's something that I haven't really looked into. I used to notice some of the old timers like White Man Run Sim, even Punicus themselves, some of the old chieftains. Every time they have a ceremonial, even dancing, they have their acoustic. Nothing special, it's just sometimes just a fresh willow they tie, maybe eagle feather or some serum symbolism on there. And that's all there is to it, and sometimes they just throw it away and get another one, and whether they keep the original one, I don't know anything about. I better check into that.
In my notes here, I seem to indicate that Dr. Ewers has asked sometime or other whether the Crow clans were ever residential units, such as at the time of the Sundance or